Hello, class. I hope you are all sitting comfortably. Just a few parish notices to get out of the way before an episode properly brimful of great stories and glorious historical idiots and an incredibly erudite guest who you will hear by the end gets in a right old ruck with me. Anyway, first things first, we've got some more Patreon members. Thank you very much and welcome to Jennifer D'Souza and to Tom Dewar. They have donated $3 and $5 respectively, which means that they will get all sorts of extra material that goes up on our Patreon page, and Tom will get to choose a topic for us to make an episode about. On that note, I should say, if you are a Patreon donor, you may have been looking at our Patreon page and going, no extra material in June, what's going on there? I'll tell you what's going on there, guys. Parenthood during a global pandemic made Ben a forgetful boy. So instead, this month, you're going to get a double helping, like a century, an extra half episode worth of offcuts that I'll be dropping... probably on Wednesday. So just in time to meet your extra content needs. As Barry alluded to in the previous podcast, Tom and Jennifer hopping aboard means we're just two away from you setting us the marvellous homework of having to turn this podcast into a book and hopefully hawking it out to publishers. So if you were... I mean, we're hoping to do it anyway, but the difference is, once we get to 50 people, that'll sort of be enough to act as a very modest advance on a book, I guess. And obviously, as we get closer and closer to publication date, we will be uploading chapters and extra stories and pictures and all sorts of stuff, which hopefully you guys can help us out with and give us feedback on. Talking of feedback, if you are a new listener or indeed an old one, you're listening to this and going, hey, I'd love to help you, but the purse strings are a bit tight at the moment, you can rate and review us on iTunes, which is an incredibly helpful way of making us more visible. Now, I'm going to choose my words on this carefully, but we sort of stopped banging the review drum until a few weeks ago, and then we started banging the review drum, at which point some of the reviews we got were one-star ones, based not really on the content and more on the fact that we threw some adverts in and me and Barry like laughing a lot in each other's company. There are going to be some adverts coming up on the show, not because we are suddenly in the pocket of Big Oil or Big Mac, but because we're doing advert swaps with our mates, many of whom have appeared on the show before, so we can advertise the show on their podcast, they can advertise their show on ours. We will never put adverts in here that we think you guys won't like or aren't relevant. They're all people who we respect as podcasters and performers. They'll only be a minute long. If it upsets you greatly, please don't review us, but hopefully you can either just listen, enjoy and discover new podcasts, or just hit the fast forward button. Before we launch headlong into this week's episode, I get to give you two heads up about comedy doings of mine tonight at 8 p.m. British Summer Time. Is the very last streaming show I'll be doing of Good Ship Comedy. We've got an incredible lineup, including Lost Voice Guy, who is the winner of Britain's Got Talent in, it was either 2018 or 2019, I think it was 2019, and a chap called Rob Kemp performing some of his show The Elvis Dead, which is the Evil Dead if the lead character was Elvis and sang the plot of The Evil Dead. It's going to be great fun. So you can watch that on Facebook Live and Twitch. And if you live in and around South London and you want to see some actual live comedy, I am putting on a show as part of the New Normal Festival on August the 6th. It's an incredible lineup. We've got Jake Lambert, who's a brilliant gag writer. You might follow him on Twitter as @littlelostlad. And also Susie Ruffle, who has been on the Jonathan Ross Show and Live at the Apollo and Have I Got News For You. And our great pal Sindhu V, who is on all of the great TV shows because she's a fantastic performer and has previously been on this show as a guest. It's going to be totally safe. Masks worn, temperatures taken on the door. We will take addresses so we can do track and trace. And it's going to be socially distanced. It's only going to be a quarter capacity. But it's going to be a banger of a show. I will put the ticket link in the link to this podcast. But if you want to come along, it is £20. You can buy the tickets on Sea Tickets on August the 6th. There'll be another show 2 weeks after that, but obviously I'll plug it later. So yeah, if you are planning on coming along to that, do tweet us and let us know. You can do that on @worstfoot, @BenVanderveld, @goodshipcomedy, or @BazMcStay. Just let Barry know that you're coming to watch me. Right. I think that is all T's crossed and I's dotted. Please sit back, pop on a dusty lab coat and some scratched goggles, and enjoy this week's episode all about the world's worst scientist. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast where each week we celebrate the best of the worst. I'm Ben Vanderveld, and this week you find me in the Worst Foot Forward laboratory, huffing gas taps, ringing bell jars, licking Bunsen burners, and seeing just how many pipettes we can insert in all of the orifices in our face. Current podcast record is 17, and we'd be genuinely delighted to know if anyone can beat us with photographic proof. The trick is to tip your head back and rest them in the nasal cavity so you end up looking like a glass-faced Zoidberg. And with me is the scientific method to my hastily assembled conclusions, Barry McStay.
And the method to your madness.
Yes, that too. I genuinely thought until I was well into my 20s that all scientists, when they wrote stuff up, had to do what we did for GCSEs and have hypothesis, method, whatever the middle bit was, conclusion.
And there we have why Ben is not a scientist. Whatever the middle bit is.
Yeah. I mean, that is my approach to quite a lot of work. I have an idea. There's whatever the outcome is. And then the bit in the middle that is quite vague and involves quite a lot of self-loathing and eating Monster Munch.
You're the embodiment of that meme, idea plus question mark equals profit.
I am a human memed question mark. Yeah. Were you only good at science at school?
Oh, no, I hated it. I dumped it as soon as I possibly could after junior cert, which is the Irish GCSEs. Yeah, I dropped all science subjects and business subjects, which explains everything that's happened to me since. I don't think I had very good teachers, so I didn't particularly... Oh, God, if any of them are listening to this. But I didn't enjoy being in those classes. But, yeah, I think I'm much more... I think I would have enjoyed the sort of the more creative edges of science than the sitting down and learning about the periodic table and learning what G means and all of those sort of things.
Well, the problem is, like anything, you've got to learn to do your scales first, don't you, in any subject? And learning your scales in creative subjects are way more fun than learning your scales in scientific topics. Like, I remember in physics, about 6 weeks passed by where all we did was put weights on a spring and... tabulate it, and I think I know what's going to happen when you put more weights on that spring. I'm going to get even bolder. That's what's going to happen.
And then a physics teacher comes and goes, actually, you shouldn't call them weights because actually they're probably more accurately described as masses.
Yeah, but you went to an Irish public school. Everything was described as a mass if they could.
This is very true. Here, let me introduce our guest. Our guest this week is essentially a walking CV. He is a doctor... He is a doctor of genetics with knowledge of how the heart forms in human. He alone knows the secret of love. He's a comedian, a fellow of the Wellcome Trust, a fellow of the British Science Association, chair of the Royal Society of Biology's Science Communication Awards, a previous winner of the Josh Award, which celebrates the work of science communicators, chair of two judging panels for the National Public Engagement Awards, and an advisor to various public engagement projects across Europe. He was also head of public engagement at UCL, which at this point makes him someone with more engagements than Liz Taylor. As a comedian, he hosts and runs Science Show Off, a clever and chaotic comedy show, as well as History Show Off, Books Show Off, and Engineering Show Off, the four basic food groups for nerds. Dr. Anna Porshaisky has said, "My career wouldn't be where it is today without Steve." And you know how they say you appear twice on Worst Foot Forward, once on the way up and once on the way down? Dr. Anna Porshaisky has been on this show twice. So well done, Steve. We welcome, for the first time, Steve Cross.
Hello, friends. It's tremendously lovely to be here. I don't know where you got the biography. I'm not head of public engagement at UCL. I haven't been for 5 years.
He was past tense.
That's yes. The key that we want. Yeah, no, I don't want them suing me. Someone else has got to do that godforsaken job now. How are you both? I love that you're so miserable. about science, because that's the point. Science lessons are meant to be miserable and crap, because what that does is get rid of people who want joy in their lives from scientific careers later on. I'm very against the idea of showing children things blowing up and going, that's science, that's science. It's not. Science is drudgery and moving tiny amounts of liquid from one tube to another and swearing at a computer. If you want to blow things up, join the fucking army.
That is very true, because then you get to weed out. It's the best way. You don't want to get people's hopes up. You want to get the people who are really interested in the granular, difficult drudge work.
When I was doing chemistry A level, my teacher was so bad, some of us went and complained to the head of science at the school. And the head of science at the school said, oh yeah, he's intentionally very bad to get you ready for university.
Oh, right. I thought you meant that they'd employed him as a bottleneck.
No, well, he was supposed to be like, well, you know, we know we'll all pass your A-levels, whatever. It's one of these crammer schools where we teach you everything. So we're teaching you the soft skill of dealing with inept pricks.
I think I've told you this before, Ben. We had in my chemistry class, a substitute teacher came in for a few months who, worse than most Irish people, couldn't pronounce her THs. So everything was dis, dat, d's and o's with her. And so our favourite thing in the world, she also wasn't a very good and very focused teacher, but our favourite thing in the world to do go was, Miss, can you remind us again what the periodic number for arsenic is? We've forgotten. I've got a 33. Why do you guys keep asking me that?
Have you met? So I have recently been hanging out with lots of Irish people due to having kids with one of them. And have you met Irish people who've gone so far the other way? They're so busy not to say ter that one of my relatives, I won't say which, always refers to the River Thames.
Yes.
She doesn't want to sound like a thick Irish person calling it the Thames. Yeah.
My husband gives out to me for saying Thailand. He's just like, no, it's Thailand. You're like, but we say Thai food. And yeah, I say Thames because I think, and he's like, no, the Thames. Like, no, it's, you stop putting it. You want us to say our THs and then you put in ones. You say, no, actually don't say these ones.
You're so desperate to sound refined and English like what me and Ben are.
I only shop at Thai rack.
It is, to be fair, like that is, the Irish's greatest overcompensating linguistically, whereas English or British people's greatest overcompensation is to say sorry every second sentence, because we have so many people to apologise to around the globe for our imperial ambitions.
This is why you need to have children with an Irish person, because then your children are Irish and literally every meal that you make them counts as reparations.
Well, Steve, you're clearly very good at putting into action the Good Friday Agreement. What are you worst at in the world?
So the thing I think I'm worst at, and it's a thing everybody tries, so I think it's actually an achievement being worst at it, is a really basic skill, and it is drawing.
Ah.
I cannot draw anything to look like anything ever. Never have been able to my entire life. Like in my 20s, I got deeply into kind of conceptual and abstract art as a way to talk about this and dismiss anyone who could draw with kind of pseudo intellectual arguments. But it's got so bad that when I used to have jobs, like if you ever go on one of those one day retreat things where they get someone creative to talk to you and they just put paper out on the floor and there's loads of different art supplies and they go, everybody just draw anything you want. There's no judgment in this room. Just draw anything. We can all draw. We all know how to draw. Yeah. I walked out. Yeah. Just rather than live through the shame of having the man who'd said we must reject the tyranny of quality. It's like, yeah, but then you're saying we can all do it and we can do it well, mate. I realize it's very difficult, this, for a listening medium.
Yeah.
But nothing. Can't draw anything.
When you say I can't draw, I really want to see how bad you are at drawing, and by going,
so you're one of those people.
But I want to make you draw a horse, which is the most notoriously difficult thing to draw, even if you're good at drawing.
The thing I learned ages and ages and ages ago, because I can't draw, is that I'm good at symbolic diagrammatic drawing. So, like, not a horse, but I can very quickly draw the international standard bodge for a horse, like an oval four legs, a sticky bit, an oval, an ear, and a smile, and people go horse straight away. So I'm amazing at Pictionary, because people who can draw are crap at Pictionary because they're busy trying to get the shading on the avocado right.
Yeah, you can listen. You can communicate. You're good at the symbology, but just not at the detail. See, I am currently in a situation with my 2-year-old who he loves drawing, but obviously he's shit at drawing because he's two. So him drawing will mostly consist of him handing me a pen and yelling at me to draw the thing until I draw it. And
you see, you've fallen into the trap already of believing that drawing is a skill. My kids are one, and what I do is that I get a giant piece of paper out, because one of the rules of like visual art is if you can't do it well, do it really big, and that compensates for how poor it is. And then I put them on it naked and just throw paint on it and let them roll around. And when they come off, you get something that could pass for abstract expressionism done by somebody who's on an undergraduate course. I've got one framed on my wall. It's like A0 size. And people come in and they go, that's really interesting. Yeah, I feel like there's a lot of expression in there. I mean, who did it? And I'm like, literally twin one-year-old.
Yeah.
I am going to have a chat, first of all, before I get to my main candidate, about something we've talked about a bit on the show before, the Ig Nobel Prizes.
Yeah!
We've talked about them a little bit. The Ig Nobels were created in 1991 by a guy called Mark Abrahams, who was the editor of and co-founder of a magazine, Annals of Improbable Research. And he's been the MC of the...
Please tell me that because it's the Ig Nobel Prize, that was spelled A-N-A-L-S.
No, I wish it wasn't. But this guy has been the MC at all the award ceremonies. And awards were presented at the time for discoveries that cannot or should not be reproduced. And so they hand out a lot of Nobel categories like physics and chemistry and medicine and literature and peace awards, but then they vary some of the other categories from year to year. So you might get an award in public health, engineering, biology, interdisciplinary research. And they do recognise genuine achievements, though they mix it with a healthy dose of satire in amongst it as well. And they even awarded 3 awards in the first year to fictitious scientists, which I think we've covered in previous shows. Most of the awards are presented by actual Nobel laureates.
And they have
and they have the ceremony in a lecture hall at MIT, originally in MIT, but now it's at Harvard. They have a lot of running jokes at the ceremony, and I think you mentioned this one before. They have Miss Sweetie Poo, an 8-year-old girl who they have a 1-minute time limit on your acceptance speech, but rather than have an orchestra start playing to play you off like they would at the Oscars or like a showbiz awards ceremony, Miss Sweetie Poo, after a minute, just starts crying out, "Please stop, I'm bored."
I think every academic in the world needs this.
Yeah. Not only that, but they usually close the ceremony with the words, "If you didn't win a prize, and especially if you did, better luck next year." They also encourage people to throw paper airplanes onto the stage during the awards ceremony. And for many years, Professor Roy J. Glauber used to sweep the airplanes off the stage as the official keeper of the broom. Glauber wasn't able to attend the 2005 awards. Do you know why?
He was dead.
Nope. He was in Stockholm claiming a genuine Nobel Prize in physics.
Oh my God, that's like winning an Oscar and a Razzie at the same time.
Well then, let me tell you about Sir Andre Geim, who is the only person to date who has been awarded both an Ig Nobel Prize and a Nobel Prize. In 2000, he won an Ig Nobel Prize for levitating a frog using its own inherent magnetism. And you can see a photo of the frog looking very unimpressed if you want to...
What with Gonzo the Great in the background?
Either of you would absolutely love to be levitated using your own inherent magnetism.
Oh,
just sit there thinking, lucky frog.
Yeah.
He's got the story for the rest of the frogs when he goes back home. What have you been up to? Just eating flies. Really? I can fly.
And in 2010, Geim was awarded a Nobel Prize for Physics for his work on an old enemy of this show's graphene.
Oh,
for studying its electromagnetic properties. I was curious to know if there had been any multiple Ig Nobel Prize winners. And indeed, there are.
Patricia Yang and David Hu have shared awards both in 2015 and in 2019, both in physics. There were a couple of other people attached to their projects as well, but both 2015, 2019 physics awards went to teams including Patricia Yang and David Hu. In 2015, they tested the biological principle that nearly all mammals empty their bladders in about 21 seconds, plus or minus 13 seconds, brackets. The paper was entitled "Duration of Urination Does Not Change with Body Size."
Oh, I thought that was going to start burst into a Gilbert and Sullivan patter song.
Yeah. Sadly, yeah, they didn't push it that far. And in 2019, having done the number one, they went for number twos, because in 2019, their paper was entitled "How Do Wombats Make Cubed Poo?"
I mean, it's a good question that needs answering.
Yeah, it needs answering now.
Well,
you read it.
Yeah, they do produce cubed poo, and not, I mean, it sounds like a dumb paper, but apparently the wombat research might lead to discoveries about colon cancer. And you can go
might
to
in any scientific thing,
yeah,
though.
Yeah, to
might
be fair.
Means won't. That's why scientists say it.
Patricia Yang says, people underestimate the power of silliness, and the Ig Nobel Prize takes advantage of that. The Ig Nobels make people think, people share the news among friends, talk about it, and eventually think about it. The wombat poo one isn't the only one that's shown some use in the wider world. In 2006, a study showing that one of the malaria mosquitoes is attracted equally to the smell of Limburger cheese and the smell of human feet won the Ig Nobel Prize in biology. And as a direct result of that, around Africa, in areas which were particularly affected by this species of mosquito, they placed traps baited with this cheese to combat malaria outbreaks. So, you know, useful in its own way.
It's useful for the people who make that cheese, because yes, no one wants to eat it because it's gross. So sell it as an anti-malarial. Just get it as far away from my fridge as possible, please. Thank you very much.
I read some other ridiculous things that have won Ig Nobel Prizes. In 1993, the Ig Nobel Prize for Literature was presented to T. Morrison, E. Topol, R. Califf, F. van der Werf, P. W. Armstrong, and their 972 co-authors for publishing a medical research paper which has 100 times as many authors as pages. Yeah, the whole article was called an international randomized trial comparing four thrombolytic strategies for acute myocardial infarction. It was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, and it took up pages 673 to 682, so 9 pages. And the authors came from Australia, Belgium, Canada, France, Germany, Ireland, Israel, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, New Zealand, Poland, Spain, Switzerland, the United Kingdom, and the United States. All 970 odd of them. In 2019, the Medicine Prize went to Silvano Gallus for collecting evidence that pizza might protect against illness and death only if the pizza is made and eaten in Italy. The Chemistry Prize, same year, 2019, the Chemistry Prize for Japanese scientists who calculated how much saliva a typical 5-year-old produces in one day. Anyone want to guess how much saliva a typical 5-year-old produces?
A day? Oh, a litre.
Half a litre. Half a litre, apparently. An Iranian inventor won an engineering prize for his nappy-changing machine. And you can all tell the rough age of all of these scientists who are studying, like, 5-year-olds and nappy changes and things. And Dutch researchers won an economics prize when they discovered that banknotes can spread infectious microbes, none more so than the Romanian banknote, the Liu. But my favourite award from that year went to Roger Miusse and Buras Benguf-Difa. They were awarded a prize for, and I quote, "measuring scrotal temperature asymmetry in naked and clothed postmen in France." They recruited French postmen to settle a mystery, which had previously received little attention, whether a man's testicles are both the same temperature.
I mean, it makes me happy on one level, but on another level, we can't extrapolate from French postmen to anybody else.
Yeah, I don't know why specifically they picked the postman.
No, I like the fact that they went super, super, super specific. But now that if you ask them questions like, which ball is hotter on men? They're like, well, we can't speak for all men.
Only for the control group.
More research is needed in this area. We've got to do German postmen.
Yeah.
We've got to do Swiss postmen. Then we've got to do French artists, French musicians.
Milkmen.
Yeah.
Well, apparently, they crunched the numbers from some sensors they placed on the testicles. And according to the studies, the left one is warmer, but only when the man has his clothes on. Apparently, It's less clean cut when the person is naked. And Britain won an award. Francis McGlone, a researcher at Liverpool's John Moores University, shared an Ig Nobel Peace Prize because he was part of an international team that helped map out which parts of the body are the most pleasurable to scratch.
Oh, I like that sort of experimentation.
Where do you... Yes. A little bit of role play, a little bit of experimentation.
Yeah, can I be a subject in that experiment?
Do you want to guess which part of the body is the most pleasurable to scratch?
Just for clarification, is it scratch yourself or have someone else scratch?
Oh, I...
Because they're very different for me.
I think it may be your own scratching. I think it is your own.
Back of my head for me.
Yeah.
I love this.
I like that. Ben?
Either behind the ear or the gooch.
Yeah. Apparently, the top one was the ankles.
Oh, I can see that. Yeah, I don't feel it immediately, but once I start, it's hard to stop.
Yeah, apparently that your back and your forearm are the next two on the list. McGlone said, the thing that's fascinated me for a long while now is why is scratching an itch so bloody nice? He said there is a serious side to the research because people can have chronic itch, and people with chronic itch will scratch and scratch and scratch until it bleeds because the pain is preferable to the itching. And so by understanding which parts of the body are most prone to itch and which are the most susceptible to relief, they can hope to find treatment for the condition.
Just noticed there is a scab on the back of my right ankle.
Have you been scratching it for pleasure?
I must have scratched something or been bitten by something, but I am living embodiment of this research.
That's amazing.
There's a little red bit.
By the way, you know the Nobel Prize gives you the real Nobel Prize, you get a cash award. I think it's 750,000 krona or something. Or maybe 1.25 million, I can't remember. The winners of the Ig Nobel Prize receive a cash prize as well. It's $10 trillion.
Mm-hmm.
It's the $10 trillion bill from Zimbabwe, which is now obsolete.
That seems cruel and unnecessary to drag Zimbabwe's hyperinflation into this.
I then read about panspermia.
Oh! The best titled, most disappointing scientific idea ever.
Do you want to tell Ben what it is?
Panspermia is the idea that life didn't start here on Earth, but in fact it was spread from somewhere else. And there are in fact little grains of life spreading throughout the universe. And that's it. Is that it?
Yeah, basically that it could be spread by space dust or on comets. One of the arguments behind it says that there is a type of bacteria in Morocco that can survive being heated up to 420 degrees centigrade, so it would be able to survive in a comet.
It's quite a alluring idea, though, the idea that life, the genesis of life is such a confusing thing that and hard to pin down thing that why couldn't it arrive via an asteroid?
Well, it's been around as an idea for quite a long time. The first mention of the term was in 5th century BC Greek philosopher's writings, Anaxagoras. It's mentioned in the 1800s, especially. Kelvin wrote about it. And even Stephen Hawking in 2009, he stated that life could spread from planet to planet or from stellar system carried on meteors at a symposium. You can get into more specific areas of panspermia, though, with the idea of directed panspermia. There is an early science fiction book, Last and First Men, by Olaf Stapledon, published in 1930. He writes about how the last humans, when they discover the solar system is about to be destroyed, send microscopic seeds of a new humanity towards potentially habitable areas of the universe. In 1966, Shklovsky and Carl Sagan suggested that life on Earth could have been seeded by panspermia from other civilizations. And in 1973... Francis Crick wrote about it as well. As in DNA dude Francis Crick. So, you know, a lot of people with very big degrees and lots of letters after their name are into the idea of panspermia, which I had never heard of. Directed panspermia may be a specific area a bit too far, though. Nobel Prize winner, I should say, also Francis Crick.
I mean, it's a bit of an intellectual cop-out, though, isn't it? Where did life come from? Somewhere else. All right, but where did it come from there? We don't know. Right, get back to working out how life can possibly arise. It's way more exciting. It's just like waving your hands and saying a wizard did it.
Or yeah. God did it.
Where did life come from? God made it happen. Also, directed panspermia. Imagine how good a shot that would have to be. When they talk about how difficult it is, the maths, to get a satellite in orbit or to land on the moon, or the people who landed a little lander on a comet that was going past, this amazing maths. Imagine just looking thousands of light years away at some planet and going, yeah, I reckon I can hit that from here.
I can jizz on that. I read about some scientists who died in the conduction of their own experiments. Carl Schiele, he discovered oxygen, even though Joseph Priestley is the one who, you know, published that he found it first and gets all the kudos for it. He discovered molybdenum, tungsten, manganese and chlorine. This is in the 1700s. But he had a habit of using all of his senses in his work.
Good lad.
Including smell and taste. He did taste test hydrogen cyanide, but the cumulative exposure to mercury and lead and fluoric acid and other stuff led him to die thanks to heavy metal toxicity at the age of 44.
Are you even a proper scientist if you don't die from exposure to some of the things you're experimenting with?
Also, like, 18th century, living to 44 is not bad going.
It's not bad, yeah.
It's not like he died early. He just died of old age with a hint of metal poisoning.
Imagine if he'd actually not eaten any of the metal. He could still be alive today with that constitution.
Yeah, probably. Probably.
Alexander Bogdanov, he was a physician. He's another one with a lengthy list of job titles. Physician, economist, philosopher, natural scientist, science fiction writer, poet, teacher, politician, and revolutionary. He's an early pioneer of cybernetics and founder of the world's first institute devoted entirely to blood transfusions, the Soviet Institute for Blood Transfusion, which he opened in 1926. He went on to perform 11 transfusions on himself, which he said helped cure his balding and improved his eyesight.
Wow.
His last transfusion had malaria and TB in it, sadly, and put an end to his research. Also, I read about a couple of people who had worrying experiences while part of the Manhattan Project. Harry K. Daglian Jr., he was part of the Manhattan Project, and during an experiment in August 1945, he dropped a tungsten carbide brick onto a plutonium bomb core. Now, I'm no scientist, but those two things sound like they don't belong together.
Nothing sounds like it belongs to the plutonium bomb core, apart from a swift walk in the other direction.
Well, how would you try and extract it again to prevent a reaction?
How would I?
Yeah.
I'm not going anywhere near that stuff. That's physicist work. They're expendable.
Daglian had to reach in and remove the brick by hand.
No!
Oh, no thanks.
Stopped a critical reaction, but was exposed to a huge amount of radiation and died 25 days later. And
good.
Louis Slotin also
What's
worked
on... What's your statue made out of? Tungsten carbide or plutonium? Those are the only two options.
Yeah. Louis Slotin also worked on the first nuclear bomb project in America. He accidentally dropped... Very clumsy people, these people. He dropped a sphere of beryllium onto a second sphere, causing a critical accident because they were wrapped around a plutonium core, these spheres. Other scientists in the room were said to have witnessed a blue glow of air ionization and felt a heat wave. Slotin was the closest to it. And apparently he died 9 days later. The amount of radiation he was exposed to was the equivalent to standing just 4,800 feet away from an atomic bomb explosion.
Wow.
Yeah.
Why do they make them spheres? They should put handles on them.
Yeah.
This is the sort of nonsense that gets these scientists in trouble. They always just want to think about things as spheres because it makes the maths easier.
Yeah.
Just put some handles on it, guys.
But my choice for the world's worst scientist, I am going to the area of mind control, and I'm going to talk about Jose Delgado.
Yeah.
Jose Delgado, born 1915, died 2011. He was a very prestigious guy. He had a professorship at Yale. His main interest was in the area of mind control. His early work focused a lot on cats, but later on in life, he transitioned to working with monkeys, humans, and famously, a bull. He used an invention called a stymoceiver, which is a radio which joined a simulator of brainwaves with a receiver, which monitored EEG waves and sent them back on separate radio channels. Basically, little electrodes, and he could remote control radio waves in your brain. Some of them were really small, like small as like a half dollar, so they weren't very intrusive. Some of his early stuff was the typical wire stuck to your head, but he managed to get it down to quite a small, quite unobtrusive object. He said
Basically, he could use it to stimulate emotions and control behaviour. According to him, he said, stimulation of different points in the amygdala and hippocampus in the four patients produced a variety of effects, including pleasant sensations, elation, deep thoughtful concentration, odd feelings, super relaxation, coloured visions, and other responses. Delgado said that brain transmitters can remain in a person's head for life, which is one of the most terrifying sentences I've ever read. And yeah, you can control them via these little radio receivers. He found he could not only elicit emotions, but also specific physical reactions. So like making people move a limb or clench a fist, which he used by stimulating the motor cortex. One human who he did this to said, I guess, doctor, that your electricity is stronger than my will. Some of the euphoric feelings he could induce in people were strong enough to overcome physical pain and depression, which is what he said he was mainly focusing on. But given that, you know, a lot of the work he did was on desperately ill patients with who were either schizophrenic and epileptic, it does seem a little bit like taking advantage. In Rhode Island, for example, he did work at a now closed mental hospital. He implanted electrodes in about 25 patients who had previously resisted other treatments. And he was able to elicit all of these different reactions and I think even induce orgasm in some people. But his most famous experiment involved a bull at a Cordoba bull breeding ranch. He stepped into the ring with a bull which had a stimulator implanted within its brain and had it charge at him. And he calmly took out a remote control, pressed a button, and the bull stops while charging at him. And he had it taped, and you can all go and Google it because it's on the internet. You can watch it today if you want to. Yeah. So he said that he by his stimulus, he caused the bull to lose its aggressive instinct. He also conducted experiments on a female chimpanzee named Paddy. Paddy had a stimulator which detected a brain signal called a spindle, which is emitted by the amygdala. And when the spindle is recognized, the stimulator then sent a little pulse, creating an aversive reaction, basically caused pain to the chimpanzee. So it gave negative feedback to the brain. And eventually, within hours, the brain started producing fewer spindles as a result of the negative feedback it was getting every time it had a spindle. So he was literally mind-controlling a chimpanzee by making its brain act differently, training its brain to avoid something that would cause a negative experience for the chimpanzee.
Now, this all sounds wonderful. How do we know that he wasn't just electrocuting these animals and humans into behaving the way he wanted them to?
I mean, essentially he was. Essentially he was. He said his device only impacted on people's aggressions, but he kept striving for ways to achieve much more specific mind control. He once said, and this is why I think he's the world's worst scientist, we must electronically control the brain. Someday armies and generals will be controlled by electric stimulation of the brain. And if that doesn't make you think immediately evil scientist, he must be stopped, then nothing else will.
Do you need more sketch comedy in your life?
This is a flesh-eating bacteria I stole from work.
Well, you stole that from the lab, did you, mate?
Yeah.
Then you need Crowley Time with me, Tom Crowley. With me, Tom Crowley.
When did you lose your virginity?
2nd of October 1993 on a pool table.
Each episode features brand new sketches, characters and songs.
No time to die and no love to lose. That's the life I choose.
As well as returning regular features.
These are the diaries of Link Tangent, space cartographer.
I'm Sir Chantley Buffingham.
Hello, my name is Wingnut.
All written, performed and produced by me, Tom Crowley.
He may look frightening, but he's innocent. He knows not what he does.
Over 4 hours of original sketch comedy, available now on all good podcast apps and at CrowleyTime.com.
Have you ever had constipation? No, it can be a bit like that.
That's Crowley Time with me, Tom Crowley. Subscribe today.
Crowley Time!
So I thought about lots of different ways of doing worst. I have a friend whose PhD was to read the diaries of the men who founded the Royal Society, Britain's club for distinguished scientists, a government-funded big organization. They were pretty much uniformly creeps who would have been Me Too'd out of existence in 2020. I didn't go for them. I thought that was the wrong way. I thought I would go for an absolute classic of the science communication world, a man who illustrates the wrong ways that scientists and technologists think about loads of things. And I've gone for Thomas Midgley Jr.
Friend of the show.
Is he fucking bollocks?
Yeah, oh,
Sorry, friends.
No, listen, he's definitely right up there in the pantheon.
Yeah, and it's a while since we've talked about him.
Okay, well, the reason I chose him was I went and looked at Time Magazine's list of the 50 worst inventions the human race has ever come up with. And there's some really terrible things on here that have caused untold misery, like New Coke or Clippy from Microsoft Word or mixing honey and vinegar together. Time Magazine had all of these as the worst things that have ever been invented. But as far as I know, the only person who invented two of the things on the list was good old Thomas Midgley Jr., the man who decided to put lead in petrol and the man who decided to put CFCs in fridges and aerosols. The man who probably has killed more human beings than anybody else. A man who, like, the last study of lead was about 10 years ago in the US, and it calculated that 400,000 people a year are still dying early because of the effects of lead petrol. Even though it's been banned since basically the 1980s, there's still enough in the atmosphere that it is killing six figures a year. Like, this guy, what I love about him is that he had no idea any of this was going to happen. He wasn't a bad person. He was just a person trying to solve problems. But he was trying to solve problems that maybe they shouldn't have solved in the first place. Imagine a world where when you discover that petrol is a bit of a shit fuel, you go, let's just not use it. Let's build our entire economy around burning ethanol, which we can use. It's from plants. It's renewable. We can just grow plants and put it in there. That would be good. And then someone goes, well, I've got this really minor technological fix that will make this, it'll make it so we don't have to use this fuel that comes from plants. We don't have to do more investigation into electricity. Like, we've got electric trams. Let's not do anything more to try and work out how to do electric transport. Well, oh, what's the little thing? What's the little thing we can do to make petrol, which we already know is a terrible idea, work? Well, I'm going to take one of the most toxic things in the world and we're going to burn it and put millions of tons of it in the air every year. Just so that we don't use fuel made from plants. And they're like, yep, that's fine. I'm sure there's no negative ramifications to this tiny technological fix.
But the worst of it is that that's the 1910s, 1920s that he came up with. And I think it was to deal with rattling in iron engines, particularly. But knocking.
That's why old cars sound so hilarious when they're like, it's knocking, yeah.
But also, at that point, people were cottoning on to the idea that lead wasn't all that healthy for people.
Well, I think Thomas Midgley was cottoning on to the light. So what I love is the difference between Thomas Midgley's rhetoric for how brilliant, not lead, but tetraethyl lead, how different his rhetoric was and what actually happened. So if you go back to the wonderful story of his life. So in 1924, he participated in a press conference to demonstrate how safe his additive was, where he poured it over his hands, placed a bottle under his nose, breathed it in for an entire minute, and said he could do this every day without having any problems.
But at that point, he was really high, presumably.
Well, there's that. But also, the year before, he had to take most of the year off to cure himself of lead poisoning. He took a long vacation in Miami. Now, I want you to imagine how sick you must be that the air in Miami counts something clean that will purify you.
Oh, it's one of Florida's greatest spa towns, Steve.
Yeah, well, that's the wonderful thing. And the super fun thing was, so he did all this. By the way, he got lead poisoning again very quickly after the conference. You'll be unsurprised to hear.
Yeah.
And then later in his career, when he invented CFCs, he basically did the same thing. He took a big mouthful of CFC, sprayed it back in the glass, was like, no problems with this stuff. Like, he's the guy that, I don't know if any of you are old enough to remember BSE and good old John Selwyn Gummer feeding his daughter a beef burger and going, there's absolutely no problems with this at all. I just love that he invented the idea of knowingly having stuff that you know is going to fuck you up, but just for the press conference purposes. Go, well, lead poisoning won't make me keel over in the press conference, so I'll get away with it. He's just such a mess and so illustrative of how scientists just make terrible errors. And it's by fixing the wrong problem. Yeah. The problem isn't that petrol knocks. is that you're using petrol. Like, one of the things that rows I've been involved in for years is so lots of people in developing nations who live mainly on rice have a terrible diet in lots of different ways. And one of the things it's deficient in is vitamin A. So there are people who are going, well, why don't we just put vitamin A in rice? It's like, well, you're solving the wrong problem. People need a rich and varied diet with protein in, and we need to not exploit developing countries so that people can only live on rice. And they're like, yeah, but vitamin A in rice. We could just put vitamin A in rice. I'm not saying it's the same as lead in petrol, but it's the same thinking.
It's not looking for a route around the problem. It's like looking to barrel through the problem.
Yeah, precisely. And you know, if you've ever told a lie, the thing to do is admit you told a lie and back up, not to keep adding to the lie.
Yeah.
Trying to think, oh yeah, I'll be all right. I'm sure, like, she won't find out. And I'm only planning to stay with her for another 60 years. I'm sure there won't be any problems in any.
I love the idea of putting lead in petrol as the scientific equivalent of living a lie.
Yeah, well, it is. Because just the company wanted to sell it. And they were like, we can't let these people making ethanol, can't let them get in with their hippie ways. There weren't hippies then, but probably they invented the word hippie just for it. And so, yeah, it's just, also just the understatement of his Wikipedia page. Midgley's legacy has been scarred by the negative environmental impact of leaded gasoline and Freon.
I'd say that is his legacy.
Yeah, you killed millions of people. That is the main thing you did. Like, a few people in the 40s got somewhere slightly quicker.
Yeah, like, he's been scarred in the same way that a man who's had his face ripped off by a bear has been scarred. I love the thought. I never realised that he still, decades after his death, he's still killing 400,000 people a year. It's like Elvis 50 years later, still shifting units.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah, he's still giving. The hole in the ozone layer is not fixed yet. There's still unnecessary deaths in the southern hemisphere from that. It's the old thing, you know. Give a man a knife and he'll kill someone. Teach a man to make an infinite knife that kills forever. And the number of people he kills will go on and on and on. It's that old saying, just like put together through Thomas Midgley. I like the fact he kept the junior throughout, like, original Thomas Midgley. It's just sitting there going, you've really ruined my name forever. Yeah,
there was no Thomas Midgley the third.
No.
Because there were, like, accidents and people getting ill in the factories as well, where they were manufacturing it in the refineries. And so they were clearly, like, well aware of what they were doing. They just kept sort of going, well, we'll overlook that because we're shifting quite a lot of cars and a lot of petrol now.
That's the great thing. I'm sure it'll be somebody else's problem in the future. And I feel bad for him in that lead did catch up with him during his life.
Hmm.
I mean, literally while he was making it. But CFCs, he got to die thinking, well, I did that lead thing, but at least I made up for it with CFCs.
But you know how he died as well.
Yes.
Go on, remind that he was wheelchair bound or bed bound and he needed a machine.
He got polio because apparently lead could kill him but not all the stuff in his system.
Yeah.
And he invented this really complicated, like, Heath Robinson-y machine for getting himself out of bed, but then it strangled him.
Yeah. It's like the world's saddest episode of Wallace and Gromit.
Yeah, well, that's a nice way of looking at it. So I went and looked up the rest of his patents because he's really famous for having loads and loads and loads of patents.
Oh, great.
And, well, most of them are really boringly rubber-related, like metal apparatus for building tire casings or incorporating cords in rubber sheets or belting of rubber or improvements in tubing. And then it's like he's just been hiding away somewhere in the middle. Method to kill millions.
I have only got two things that I would like to tell you about. First of all, we are going to Commerce Township in Michigan in the early 90s. And our hero is a man called David Charles Hahn, or as he was known at the age of 17, the Radioactive Boy Scout. Because he managed to build a nuclear reactor in his backyard.
Why?
It's gone a bit back to the future, hasn't it?
Yeah.
It is a little bit, yeah. So he was fascinated by chemistry and physics from a young age. He had been given the Golden Book of Chemistry Experiments and small chemistry sets as a child, but clearly not enough for him.
He outgrew the old custard powder in the tin experiment.
Yeah.
And he became fascinated with the notion of creating something called a breeder reactor, which, I'll be honest, I'm not scientifically literate enough to describe what it is.
Oh, but, I'll do it for you. It's what you do is you need two lumps of uranium and three people who've had kids, and you put them all in a box, and it produces energy.
Perfect. So we can add kidnap to his litany of crimes. And he diligently amassed radioactive material by collecting all sorts of household products that had little bits of it in. So he took americium from smoke detectors and thorium from camping lanterns and radium from clocks and tritium from gun sights. Thank goodness for him at the time that America had such poor health and safety legislation when it came to its product control. And his reactor was made from a bored out block of lead, and he used lithium from $1,000 worth of purchased batteries to purify the thorium ash by using a Bunsen burner.
$1,000 worth of batteries.
Yep.
Wow, that is...
I mean, I'm a nerd. That's what I get through in an average year.
Yeah.
He also, when necessary, posed as either an adult scientist or a high school teacher in order to gain the trust of many professionals to give him pieces of advice and to describe what he was doing.
Hello, I'm an adult scientist. You can tell that by my very sturdy mustache and by this monocle. Sir, you seem to be standing on a pair of tin cans. No, no, these are just very tall platform adult shoes I'm wearing.
You keep referring to everything you're doing. Yes, I'm speaking to you on the adult telephone whilst having just had my adult lunch, and I'm now off later to talk to my adult wife. It got to a stage when it hadn't yet become what would be described as a reactor, but was emitting well over 1,000 times the normal background radiation. He was alarmed by this and began to dismantle it, but in a chance encounter that I haven't really found out much more about, police discovered what he was doing and got in touch with the Federal Radiological Emergency Response Unit, which involved the FBI and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
Oh my God.
On June the 26th, 1995, the EPA, which is the Environmental Protection Agency, designated his mother's property an emergency site and urgently cleaned up the hazardous materials from there, dismantled the shed that he had made it in, and buried them in a low-level radioactive wasteland in Utah. Unknown to officials, his mother, who knew about this and was fearful she would lose her house if the full extent of radiation was known, had already collected the majority of the radioactive material and had put it in the garbage.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and they weren't able to find it.
They're gonna... Oh, was there a sudden, like, outbreak of, like, superhero rats in Michigan that year?
Oh, I'd love it if that was the case. Shortly before his lab was dismantled, he attained the Eagle Scout rank in his scout troop, and later after this, he received a merit badge in atomic energy.
I suppose if you're going to give it to any kid...
Yeah!
They invented that right, especially for him. That's not something they just have, like, oh, like, atomic energy is a standard thing the scouts...
Yeah. His story's quite sad. He went on to serve in the army, but... It's probable that his experiments had already shortened his lifespan, but later on in life he got diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia. The FBI kept tabs on him because they kept wondering that he was trying to build a second breeder reactor in his freezer. And near the time of his death, he was using cocaine heavily and was convinced that people he claimed had the ability to shock his genitals with his mind. So clearly he thought that your pal Delgado was after him.
Yeah. Oh, man. That's... Yeah, well, I mean, to be fair, the last people you want building nuclear reactors are cocaine users.
Yeah. but I mean, the people who were building them in the 40s, you know, I'm sure that they were all speed freaks and cokeheads to keep themselves awake.
Fat man, little boy, let's come up with it. I've got a crazy idea.
Yeah. But I'm pretty much immediately going to go to my suggestion. This is an incredible man who I discovered, who is basically... Well... His name is Athanasius Kircher, He was a German Jesuit scholar and polymath, and I think I can best describe him as a Poundland Leonardo da Vinci.
Yeah, I've heard of him.
He is incredible. He published around 40 major works on optics, acoustics, linguistics, mathematics, cryptology, Egyptology, numerology, and sinology. His nickname at the time was Master of 100 Arts, and whilst he got a few things right, most things he got really, really wrong.
It sounds like it's
true of all of us. Let's not pick on the poor guy.
Well, here's the thing. I'll tell you about all of the things that I found about him that he got right and wrong, and the regard in which he was held in his time and then later on in his day. He was an inventor, and some of the things he invented were quite remarkable. He invented speaking statues, eavesdropping devices, and the reason why you've probably heard of him, Barry, he is erroneously known as the inventor of the cat piano.
That's the fella. Yeah, we talked about him before.
Yeah, where he tuned up, he didn't tune up the cats. The cats, he ascertained the musical note that you would get if you hit it with a hammer.
By the way, so you said he invented speaking statues. Is that not just people?
Yeah. Is that not just people? A statue with someone standing behind it?
Pretty much what it's, I think it was a statue with a speaking tube. It was a statue with the illusion that it was able to speak.
Right.
That he collaborated with a master sculptor called Gian Lorenzo Bernini, and he made two of his most famous sculptures speak.
Was his eavesdropping device also a tube? Is he just tube guy?
He thought tubes were the answers to everything. Big fan of Mike Oldfield. He also popularised the use of these things called Wunderkammers, which are essentially a cabinet of curiosities, which is not the most scientific thing in the world, because whilst some of his curiosities were of scientific interest, other things that were in his own were a brick from the original Tower of Babel and the tail bones of a mermaid.
But prove they weren't. Mr. Smug Modern Science, prove they weren't.
Carbon dating.
Yeah, I think we have to take people at their word. They're wrong. I just think it's important to give people the benefit of the doubt. Where are we in life if we don't trust people?
Is this the guilty, innocent until proven guilty? With science, it's correct until proven wrong.
Well, every hypothesis deserves testing.
Yeah.
I like your liberal, inclusive approach to science.
Show me a mermaid, Ben, and show me their tail and how different it is to his tail, and then I'll believe you.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's go. I was going to say, let's go fishing on the Thames for mermaids, but any mermaids in there are either dead.
It's actually the Thames.
Yeah.
The Thames, yeah. What I love about him is in the preface to one of his books, he essentially did a cell phone. So he's writing about the reaction to another one of his books, and he says, "This earned considerable praise from intelligent readers who were astonished by the novelty of its subject matter, but there was no lack of malicious, evil critics who attacked it with sarcastic arguments and many attempted corrections. All of these, however, were stupid or obtuse."
Yes.
No. No, my friend. You were stupid and obtuse.
But you're adopting the same style of argument as him.
Yeah.
We're just calling each other stupid and obtuse. You have self-owned.
You're worse than
Donald
Trump.
I'm glad that you're standing up for him, Steve. But let me tell you a bit more about why he was so rubbish. He was, and this is not necessarily...
I just feel bad mocking anyone for their failures when we're all sitting in our houses recording a podcast for free.
Well, then, you, my friend...
We're actually the little people, how stupid they are. Tell me more about this person who's famous enough that you could find him online.
I mean, I'm famous enough that you could find me online, but only because I put the material about me online.
Right.
Listen, I love the guy. I love the guy, but he's he gets so much wrong. He was quite accident prone in his youth. By the time he was in his 30s.
Oh, right. So now we're picking on him for being dyspraxic as well.
Yeah.
He sounds like he should have belonged at the Manhattan Project.
It's all over the place.
A lot of podcasts like to own
the liberal woke kids. I like to own long dead early modern scientists.
Right, okay.
Because I know that there's going to be no clapback from them.
Yeah.
This dyspraxic, ramshackle human who had survived storms at sea, been washed down a river, escaped the plague, narrowly avoided being trampled by horses, and even survived an accidental trip through the grinding wheel of a mill.
Was he saved from drowning in the boat by the mermaid? Is that where he got the tail?
Yes, I imagine so. He refused to wear a disguise of worldly clothes whilst travelling through Germany during the 30 Years' War. And so his Jesuit robes attracted the unwelcome attention of some Protestant soldiers who nearly hung him from a tree until one of them, moved by his courage, had a change of heart. Finally, when he made his way to his Jesuit college as a student, which is in Würzburg, the college was dissolved within 24 hours of unbelievable confusion.
That was an experiment that went wrong.
Yeah.
don't ever make your college out of soluble material.
Yeah. A chap called John Classy, who wrote an autobiography of him entitled A Man of Misconceptions, said that many of his actual ideas today seem wildly off base, if not simply bizarre, but he was a champion of wonder, a man of awe-aspiring erudition and inventiveness. So, for example, he is seen as the progenitor of Egyptology, and he was the last guy who had a real good crack at deciphering hieroglyphics, but he was wrong all the time. He described it as being pictures as letters, riddles as sounds, in short, as many mazes to be escaped from a mountain as to be climbed. But all of his translations of them were wildly wide of the mark.
Can I ask a quick question?
You can.
What date was all of this happening?
1630s to 1680s.
It's the whole idea of inventing Egyptology seems really weird for me, because like they understood that you could study a thing and they knew that Egypt existed. I don't know where the great cognitive leap is that like, we should study that. Well, that's an incredible invention. No one possibly thought of that before. Your brain must be magnetic.
I've had a go at guessing what all of these pictures might be, so that's essentially worth a Wikipedia entry, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, it's the conclusions he came to, and great, he decided that ancient Egyptian was a language spoken by Adam and Eve, amongst other things.
Prove it wrong.
Well, if you go to our Patreon page and donate just $5 a month, you can hear an original chord recording from the Garden of Eden, where you can see that Adam and Eve were actually Brummy.
In fairness, hieroglyphics, a lot of snakes in them.
Oh, shit. That is true. I mean, that is the sort of logic that our pal Kirchner would use. In his geological and geographical investigations of the ocean, he suggested that the tides were caused by water moving to and from a subterranean ocean that he believed you could access via a whirlpool somewhere above Norway.
Wow. That's where the plug is. That's where the Earth's plug is. Yeah,
it was the early modern equivalent of the hole in the ozone layer. He thought that fossils were the remains of giant races of human beings. He thought that mountain ranges were actually the Earth's skeletal structure that had been exposed via weathering.
I mean, in a way.
Yeah, I think you just hate metaphor. So clearly beautiful. Like, you've got the Gaia theory now that the Earth is a living being, and lots of people find that very useful for doing their science. Metaphor is a vital part of understanding the world. What are the mountain ranges, if not the skeleton of the Earth? You say it like that, it starts to sound true.
Yeah, I think if you, sure. I think if you finish your sentence with arm and waft some incense around, you can get away with most things.
He also got so close to a little bit. Well, this thing, he was so close but so far, or maybe he was using metaphor to describe things he couldn't quite understand. So he believed various animals were created via hybridism. So he believed a giraffe was a mixture of a camel and a leopard.
That was fairly common.
Believed that an armadillo was the mixture of a turtle and a hedgehog, but he also believed that animals could just burst into existence out of nowhere, particularly insects and the like, and that was his explanation for why certain animals that didn't make it onto Noah's Ark but were still able to exist after the flood.
So he said certain animals weren't on the Ark, but they do exist now.
Yes, and
where did he have the full list of the inventory for the Ark?
Yeah, that's never been recovered.
Well, where's the black box from Noah's Ark?
as well as being a rather slapdash naturalist, he also believed in unicorns and griffins. I'll beat Steve to it. Prove me wrong.
So early Harry Potter fandom.
Yeah.
Clearly, yeah. He believed that mulberry trees could grow silkworms, starting from the eggs of any other kind of insect. And he was described by science historian Paula Findlay as perhaps the last naturalist to believe passionately in the reality of any dragons he saw.
And he created...
What dragons did he see?
I don't know, clearly after working with a lot of mercury, shitloads of them. To try and make his Curturanium, which was the name of his Wunderkammer, his Cabinet of Curiosities, he would create liquids provided by mechanical vomiting crustaceans that he then would convince patrons that they could hear disembodied voices, but it would just be him speaking to them via a tube through his bedroom. He also got one of his mates to taxiderm a wolf, and then he attached a megaphone to the wolf and he would howl down it to make them think that the wolves were howling. He tricked the minister of his abbey to search for an organ in the abbey that didn't actually exist, and it's instead was just him playing his Aeolian harp in the wind.
Amazing.
He tried to make people convinced that there was such a thing as cherub cats by placing wings on the cats and putting them in the Cabinet of Curiosities.
Sounds like you're the inventor of Jackass.
Yeah.
Early prankster who people began to take seriously.
All I'm taking from this is if you're a senior enough priest, so someone else grows your food, you've got a lot of spare time around then.
Yeah.
You've got to find things to do with it. There's wings lying around. There's a cat lying around. Wings go on the cat. What did you accomplish today? Well,
to be fair,
I didn't have to grow food. I got my praying done really quick. So all sorts of stuff.
Well, you know, we're all essentially, if you're a priest or a monk at that time, your existence is lockdown, and we've all been in lockdown and done mad things. He got bored of a couple of years of sourdough. Wings on a cat.
What a great scientist. We mock him now because we know the results of the experiment. Put wings on a cat. But no one had done the experiment then. You've got to do it to find out if it is negative.
Yeah,
do
I
the
suppose
wings
so.
Take, can the cat fly? Like, you've got to, like your scales from earlier, you've got to build up the science of flying cats little by little.
Yeah.
Start from the basics.
I mean, the result of if you put wings on a cat, the result is that you get claw marks all over your face.
But my favourite...
It is true, cats, and I can't remember, is it squirrels, are one of the few animals that they can reach terminal velocity and they can survive falls from quite high heights.
Anything small can. I remember being taught zoology, and there's this really famous thought experiment that Ronald Fisher did about different animals falling down a mineshaft. If you throw a mouse down a mineshaft, it lands, walks away with no idea that it's even fallen. What was the quote? A rat is slightly dazed. Cat's legs break. A human is broken. A horse splashes.
Our suggestions for the world's worst scientists are Barry's of the electrode-loving brain mangler Jose Delgado, Steve's suggestion of the returning hero Thomas Midgley Jr., the scientist with the biggest kill rate of them all, and my own beloved Poundland Da Vinci, Athanasius Kircher. Good suggestions, gentlemen. I mean, I feel right out of the traps. My suggestion is not a winner, since he has been so firmly disregarded by our guest.
Well, he did all right, you know?
Did do all right. So my... here's the thing, guys. I'm torn between a man who enjoyed electrocuting everything as his scientific modus operandi, or whether Steve bringing Thomas Midgley Jr. along means that we, Barry, should crown him as the first ever two-time winner on Worst Foot Forward.
Could be.
So are we allowed to advise the judge?
Yeah.
You are.
So I think, like, with all of these, we're talking about figures who are in the past somewhere, but we've also got to think about the effect that we'll have on science now. Because lots of people write things or do things that they think are a good laugh about science, like Richard Feynman writing his books about himself, where he's He plays this fine, literary Feynman character who's a terrible sexist and treats everyone else like shit and not as clever as him. But he accidentally did the damage that two generations of male physicists read that book and thought that's how they're supposed to behave. So I really think you should give this one to Barry for the reason that the number one problem in science isn't people getting science wrong, and it isn't people trying some things, inventing some things, and those things turning out to be bad. The number one problem in science is that we let loads of really evil people do it and we don't chuck them out. So I think the worst scientist has to be the knowingly evil scientists. And also all the people around him who were like, yeah, we'll keep funding that. Off you go, mate. Yeah, here's some more money. Yeah, come and work at our university. Do anything you like. It's all wonderful. So I don't want to talk down my own guy, but if I was in your shoes, I mean, evil has to triumph over, I mean, chaotic and chaotic good in Dungeons and Dragons terms, the other two.
That's very true. Yeah, chaotic being the operative word, I think, for Athanasius Kircher.
Yeah, precisely. Whereas your guy, lawful evil.
Yeah.
That is true. And I mean, obviously, if we're talking about evil scientists, there are an awful lot of bad, bad Nazis and bad, bad Japanese people from World War II that we have discerned.
And people who are alive now who have really good lawyers, so I won't talk about any of the things. Yeah.
Them
the
too.
Stuff. Oh. Anyway.
Well, I'm still torn, and it's I get what you're saying, that Jose Delgado did some genuinely, deliberately pretty evil things and created bad scientific practice,
but when we're talking...
Can I tell you one more story to try and win you over? I shouldn't win. 2 years ago, I was asked to do a careers talk for 15-year-olds to encourage them to study science subjects. And so what they'd done was they got four people who have science qualifications but don't work directly in science. And we were supposed to talk about our lives and how inspiring we were. The panel was a doctor who works in A&E saving lives. Next to them, a doctor who works in A&E saving lives and has their own TV show. Next to them, someone who creates computer games that sell millions, and then me, a freelance stand-up comedian. The first question I got was, why are you here? From a 15-year-old. But afterwards, a boy came up to me and he said, I'm really interested in being a scientist. I'm mostly interested in neuroscience and how you can use it to control people. And that is the sort of person that is being inspired and being led and being legitimized. I just think it's a terrible thing, and I keep telling that story just so people go, no, Steve, your career is valuable.
All right, then, in that case, first of all, no, Steve, your career is valuable.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. And since you make such a strong case for Barry's and such a vehement case against my suggestion, Jose Delgado is the worst scientist of all time.
Steve, what you don't realise is that Steve has mastered the art of mind control, Ben. And he didn't even need any radio waves.
No,
as
just
far as you know.
Of never giving up an argument, you know?
We're immediately blocking him from the Twitter account.
Yeah.
Right?
Before we go, we're just going to give you a bit of the world's best news of the week, as we'll keep doing until this lockdown shenanigans is over. And it is news to tell you that in a warehouse in deepest, darkest Devon, a world record has been broken by needle workers, because Devonian needle workers have created a bunting made of 79,000 flags that is full of messages of goodwill to the NHS and rainbows and different coloured flags, and it's just quite big and adorable and pointless.
Is it the world's largest bunting?
It is the world's largest bunting. Oh, sorry, I'm going to be more specific. The world's longest knitted bunting.
Ah. I'm so glad that was a happy story. When you started, a record has been set in a warehouse
in Devon.
My first thought was, what? The world's most inbred person.
Before we go, Steve, where can our listeners find you, and what can they find you doing when they get there?
Well, all my gigs are on scienceshow.org. If you like the sound of my voice, I have a comedy Dungeons and Dragons podcast called Chaotic Adequate that you can listen. If you want to hear me arguing not only about one person, but actually systematically destroying someone's entire world that they've invented for me to play in, that is the place to go.
Excellent stuff. Well, we're all off to erect and then destroy a statue of Jose Delgado. Until next time, goodbye, ladies and gentlemen.
Bye.
Bye, friends.